Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Limitless. This is The Limitless, the podcast in between. You are now listening. You can walk an island way and you work all the rolling dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I came walking a long way just for another chap. Then I saw her in the crowd and I looked her in the eyes.
I mean, my process is so, it's so part of the complex that's been obviously with me all my life. And I just go into the space of, I am in a complete fog. I don't know how to locate anything. I don't know how to respond. And so I guess, you know, I'm sure I know comes from the ongoing experience of being a child. Overwhelmed, slightly frightened or very frightened. Sort of nebulous reality that was living with Mum and Nick, particularly Mum. So I experience all these different, defended responses to what you're doing, and that's one of them. And the other is it's like so much more. I've got to hear more. See, you know, be aware of. I've got to take in more. I've got to accept more stuff that, you know, that is really difficult to stay open to. And this is the experience I've had with your investigations all along, really, which obviously linked directly to my own, you know, inner explorations. So today was more of the same, but
which did you have to catch up on? What had you not read?
Oh, you mean chronologically, whatever. I came, I think, from number 14, 15, 16, or 13, 14, 15, 16, 4.
Oh, well, there's a lot. Yeah.
Well, I'd read 16.
Right.
So I think I read 3 up until then. Yeah.
So that was going backwards. It was the Kinderladen, and before that was the Kinsey Crowley.
Yeah, I read
and
that.
And before that was the Islington child abuse thing. So before, you had read the one before that tied in Jimmy Savile to the NHS and
the
School
one today
of Economics.
Well. I read that one today as well.
So that's 4 then.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, that's close to the nexus, the hub, or whatever I would call it, of the whole investigation that's not personal, of the larger political investigation. The hub of it, to me, is there around connecting the NHS to the Fabian Society, into contextualising Jimmy Savile and what he was doing, and the Tavistock, and this is all. It's all new to me, but I think it's new to anyone. And of course, it may not be. I may have joined the dots prematurely, so I don't know, but...
Well, it was compelling, of course, and shocking, of course, and quite convincing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my sort of fitting with that, or how it fits with me, is... as for you, there's a personal connection because of Jimmy Boylby from Yorkshire, and...
Jimmy Savile, right?
Being from Yorkshire.
Yeah.
So as a child, there's a connection to me as a child, but there's also a connection with the Tavistock, and the, you know, you bring in Bowlby and the psychology and all, and psychologists and all that. So there's a link there for me as well. Yeah. And of course, Islington, Hampstead. You know, these are parts of my present domain. You know, my domain for the last 30 years has been as a Londoner, more or less.
Islington as well?
Islington, I don't spend a lot of time there, but it's in my backyard. So sort of quite close to home, on, you know, from two angles, really. 2 or 3, even.
Mm-hmm.
As a child, as a Londoner, as a psychologist.
Right. So that's one of the biggest, or the biggest recurring dilemma or issue or whatever that I have with this material that I was knowing I would want to bring up at some point or right away is how difficult it is to believe any of it, even yeah. though I'm the one who's presenting the evidence, finding the evidence, presenting it, making sense of it, completely convincing myself through the act or through the process of presenting it to others. But then when I step away from it, it stops making sense again.
Stops making sense.
So there's something around that.
It's really good that you say that in your writing, so mm-hmm. that we as the reader, you know, and again, speaking for myself, I feel, you know, reassured, I feel sort of grounded, and my experience, to use that kind of weird word, is normalised. You know, it's I'm not alone in my response, and even the person who is providing all of this information and you know, the person, you, who has done all this painstaking research, is still in it still has a doubt, a reaction of doubt or disbelief.
Mm-hmm.
And if so, my experience is sort of magnified. That's my experience, only magnified, you know. Mm-hmm. Can't possibly be. And it's I'm sure that you know this already, but you know, sort of working it out for myself, that it's sort of at least twofold, because part of it is just genuinely difficult to believe. The facts are so shocking
mm-hmm.
that I think that it would beg a belief from anybody. But the other part of it, of course, is a psychological defensive response. It's just because it shakes the foundations of what one actually believes one knows about living in the world, in the Western first world, in, you know, mm-hmm. normal society, progressive society, whatever, cultured society, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that we trust, I was going to say instinctively, but of course it isn't instinctive, it's a sort of knee-jerk need to trust. Well, it's a conditioned trust, isn't it? We're conditioned to trust in the NHS, we're conditioned to trust in education, up to a point at least.
Mm-hmm.
We're certainly conditioned to, you know, trust the authorities in psychology or scientists. You know, I read about Kinsey today. I mean, so that's destabilising mm-hmm. to suddenly have that in front of you saying the opposite. We cannot trust these people, not only to tell us the truth, but actually to not abuse their power.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Nobody, I don't think anybody really wants to feel that way, to know that, and to have to take it on board.
Well, it's more than, I mean, what you just said there, you can't trust authorities and of whatever shape or size or in whatever field, we can't trust the authorities to not to abuse their power. It's more than that, though, isn't it? Because you and I have both grown up more or less with a distrust of authority. But what's being revealed potentially in the exploration isn't corruption. I don't see it as corruption. Mm. I mean, I'm realising this. It's not corruption because it's the system. So to talk about corruption suggests that the system itself would work or can work or did work once but then was corrupted.
So you don't think it's ever worked? You think this has ever been thus?
I think it's ever been thus, but without even speculating on that, I think what is being revealed through these various strands of evidence or bodies of evidence is that this isn't about agendas or goals that start out good and then become corrupted. It's about goals that started out this way and have been implemented and are still being implemented by groups and individuals and philosophies, most of all, ideologies, that they may be corrupting, but that's at an individual level. Like, individuals become corrupted by ideas, false values and the rest of it. But they seemed to be serving the purpose that they set out to achieve, yeah. Not that they've got diverted or undermined or corrupted. And then, but what I'm exploring is how our own family that became part of those agendas, so it's both really, it's not either or, that there seems that there was corruption in our family, that our father was corrupted.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a bit difficult to understand then if it's...
You know, what you did there was you took what I said and you didn't contradict me, but you amplified it. You said, well, that's only true up to a point. Actually, the truth is much bigger than that, or much darker than that, or much more dangerous than that, whatever, all of the above. Yeah, it's not that the system, it's not that these people are abusing their power, it's that the entire system is built on
abuse of power. I mean, yes, yeah. They are abusing the power, but that
yeah. Yeah, but so my point is that's what this, I mean, I'm experiencing this right now, and presumably this is what your readers and your listeners are going to experience, because it's not that difficult for intelligent people who are reasonably open-minded to go to that next place of, well, yes, there's more corruption than I thought, and actually mm-hmm. this has been going on and it's horrific, but to go, but then to sort of, so I sort of feel like, okay, well, I got that far, but actually I've got to go further. I've got to go, you know, if I want to be with you in this realization, this reality, whatever, I want to take this on, then I have to go further into the dark, into the darkness, you know. I have to open up even more,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so, you know, I'm quite interested in how I didn't do that for myself, and I'm imagining it's because, you know, it's so easy to not do that. It's so easy to not go to the next level with this. Mm-hmm. So easy to say, well, it's bad, but it's
bad apples in the barrel.
A product of our time, or something that is. Mm-hmm. You know, you've still got a lot of. There's a balancing going on. There's a lot of people who are coming in for the good and.
In the narrative.
No, I'm saying it'd be easy to say that.
Right,
easy to is to present for oneself a more balanced experience of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's much, much, much harder to take on board what you're propagating or what you're discovering and putting into words and could feel like propagating. I don't know if that's the wrong word, but, you know,
mm-hmm.
putting forwards, much harder.
Yeah, well, it's hard for me to put it into words, as I've just demonstrated. One simplified way that I described it recently was that I used to believe that culture depended on conspiracies to continue itself, but I've come to see that that culture itself is a conspiracy. That the original conspiracy is the conspiracy of culture, so it's one that we're all involved in. But that's more of a soundbite than anything. It's something that one can just take on, but unless you unpack it, it doesn't really mean very much.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I was touching on with the Dawkins, is that if the proof is in the pudding, if the proof of certain philosophies is if they, and methodologies is that they get the desired results, then that justifies the actions and the compromises and all the rest of it. And so people who start out with good intentions, who begin to see more and more that the society in which they're hoping to implement these good intentions is very different than they thought, and that they'll basically be powerless, completely ineffective if they don't make compromises.
Mm.
And then the more compromises they make, the closer they get to the the level of a deviance that's working in society, in the culture, and the underlying philosophies behind it, the philosophies underlying those practices, that they're not, it's not just corruption, it's not just people trying to get a buck or trying to get sexual gratification. There is that level, but then there's a deeper level of people like Bertrand Russell or George Bernard Shaw, who genuinely believed in social reform, just like grandparents and parents believed in, and who, it seems to me, embrace philosophies and methodologies which are extremely radical and which provide a justification for the baser, lower desires to actually exploit and abuse as a means to this greater end, which, of course, the end, whatever, it's never in sight. The end is the world we've got, which is beneficial to the Dawkins and the Gore Vidals and the Jimmy Savills. It does benefit them.
Yeah.
So, but we see it didn't benefit. It didn't benefit our father, and it didn't benefit Sebastian. It hasn't benefited us. Not real well. We have the privileges of it. That's part of the conflict that I have around it. It's, you know, being complicit with this. And as you said about psychology as well, like, we're both very invested in the psychological methods and systems and all the rest of it, but we can see how they have been abused and even to some extent created in order to be used in the way that we would consider abuse. So,
yeah.
So I mean, that's the closest I have to a ground, a philosophical ground, I'd say, is psychology.
Mm. So, yeah, I mean, it's particularly destabilising then for you and for me in that way.
Mm-hmm. Not because I don't trust Jung now, I don't trust Freud. I never did trust Freud, actually, but I certainly used to trust Jung as one of the good guys.
Well, you don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater, do you? I mean, you can still, people can still be very instrumental in shining a light on a path that you can then take yourself, and you can take some of the, even some of the tools or the provisions along that journey with you. You don't have to go down that same road. You don't have to put on the same clothes as the man who, or the men, or the who have actually turned traitorous on your psyche.
Well, if they have, I mean,
if they have,
it's all unknown, and I think that's the bottom line. And so, I was going before and didn't get there, was about the culture and conspiracy, was that the way that culture creates, the way that we turn to culture to construct an identity.
Mm.
And of course it begins instinctively with trauma, and it's pre-verbal, and so we're unconsciously creating, constructing an identity from very early on, but then in childhood, we're still working on it, you know, for customizing it, and then we more and more consciously turn to the culture to create the identity, and then that identity, once it's fully operational, enters into culture, tries to achieve a certain level of status within the culture, influence, power, and then, of course, to do so, and in the process of doing so, it reinforces the culture that created it.
Mm-hmm.
So then that's the conspiracy. I mean, that it's each and every one of us, and if we're not culture makers and gatekeepers, it's only because we have failed to become that. expressed is the feeling of being overwhelmed and being bemused or disoriented by the emerging picture.
Yeah.
So, I mean that.
And that starts with young. That starts, you know, probably in the womb for both of us because mum drank throughout. Because it's a Neptunian thing, you know, that fog, that overwhelm, that bemused. Oh, bemused feels like quite a kind word for it.
Yeah.
Quite a benign word for it, you know, the sort of panic of not being able to see clearly. And
right, and I have this experience repeatedly when I'm lucid, is that and it's nightmarish, but not full-on nightmare, but that I'm aware of dreaming and I'm aware of wanting to be able to move freely in the dream, and I can't, it's not that I can't move, that's more of a lower level dreaming, but I can't see clearly anything.
Mm.
Everything is all foggy, and it's more than just visual. It's just this feeling of being kind of cocooned in this unreality.
Yeah, yeah. And it's very seductive, and probably not least, at least because we've known it from the beginning. This is how it feels for me, is that I hate the experience. I don't, you know. I panic if I have to pull some sense, some direction, some movement away, some movement towards communication or engagement.
Mm-hmm.
If I have to pull myself or clamber my way out, struggle out of the fog.
Mm-hmm.
I hate the experience. But if left to my own devices. So this is a very good example of this. You wanted to do this conversation with me, with a podcast, and my first reaction was, oh my God, are you kidding? Not a chance in hell I'll ever be able to make any sense. And it was complete panic. And I realised that, yes, okay, I had a duty to myself, if you like, horrible word duty, but, you know, like, this is important, don't run away from this. So, you know, I had a very quick word with myself, so I didn't deliver that to you straight off the bat. And it was only in sitting down this morning and actually really focusing in on where I am in this fog and how I can actually find my way out of it,
mm-hmm.
that I was able to find my way out of it. Because my conditioning, my conditioned response is to feel completely overwhelmed by it and to not fight it. I have to say, to not fight it. I mean, that's the learned helplessness. You know, you're a baby in the womb. What the hell can you do to fight it? Nothing. Mm-hmm. You just have to live in it. And, of course, mum was in a fog half the time. So it's also copied behaviour.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is an important experience for me because it reminds me and helps me learn that I don't have to. I don't have to believe that I can't get out of this fog. I don't have to believe that it's where I belong, if you like.
So, weren't you going to say, or starting to say before, that when you, that you, it's only unpleasant if you try to get out of it.
Yeah.
Part of you likes to go deeper into
totally,
it.
Totally, absolutely, that's right. Thank you for bringing me back on track. Yeah, or to following that thread, because yes, exactly. It's not unpleasant in a way. It's I'm used to it. I've experienced it from the very beginning, presumably, and B, it's the opposite of struggle. Mm-hmm. If you just accept it, but not obviously. I mean, there are times when it can be accepted in a very positive way, but obviously that's not what I'm talking about now. It's just to accept it by not questioning it.
Well, it's more than accepting, isn't it? It's actually indulging in it and wanting to use it as a way to
reinforce directly to any kind of escapism that has that quality to it.
Yeah, well, that's like the connection that you were making earlier about Neptune. So if we grew in a womb that was being fed alcohol, we were being fed alcohol intravenously. That's a great metaphor for an external value that is shaping our internal reality and distorting and polluting it.
Yeah.
And then we're born into, of course, the environment we're born into with all the values that come along with it or shape it. And whatever it is, the Neptune fantasy of movies or of music, Elvis, and later spirituality, drugs, all the rest of it.
Yeah.
Whatever it is,
yeah.
If it's external.
It's the path of least resistance, of course, and it's a retreat into the womb, which, if the womb had been a happy space, that would have been a very genuine retreat.
Well, exactly. That's interesting paradox, isn't it? Because if the womb had been a happy place, it would be much better to retreat there, much more
healthy.
Not healthy, but just a better place to be if you're going to retreat. But if the womb had been healthy, we wouldn't have the need to retreat there.
No, because everybody has a need to retreat, and it would be a template for a place of safety to retreat into, where you're held completely contained and held.
Well, then it wouldn't be retreating to the womb, would it?
Well, why not? I mean, it would be retreating into that original, what Freud called the oceanic experience, I think, didn't he? Where you're completely merged in a safe place. But we seek it by default. We feel we need it by default.
Yeah, well, because we go there every night when we sleep. So I think with a healthy experience of the womb and a healthy birth, I don't think there would be any retreating into that. Because I think it would just naturally be, well, A, we get it when we sleep, and B, we'd have it with us at all times. It's like what they say about the unhealthy mother connection, that if you don't have a strong bond to your mother, then you remain enmeshed with your mother.
Yeah, sure.
So whereas if you have a strong, good, healthy bond, then you can separate. Because
I mean, I don't know if I agree with you there. I mean, you might be right, and I'm not evolved enough to know whether I'll ever be, whether that's true, and if I was, you know, in a place where I didn't need ever to retreat, then...
Well, I mean, retreat is like it's a battle term, isn't it? If the odds are overwhelming, you retreat. So I don't think there's anything wrong with the notion of retreat per se. I'm not saying we'd just always be, you know... I'm thinking of the metaphor of a penis that's always erect, like that's not appropriate. That's a male metaphor, obviously, but still, for the self, let's say, doesn't always need to be in proactive mode. There's times where it's passive and receptive. And I'm not saying that retreat per se is unhealthy. I think just the nature of it and the association of it with the womb seems or with the mother, that would be indication of a complex, I think, is my sense.
Because
for me, the sense of retreat, when it's healthy, when it's real, is retreating into my own body.
Sure, yeah, but that doesn't mean that you can't find maybe not then, although you've got Moon Pisces, so that surprises me.
Yeah, because the womb is where something's grown, so I don't know. I mean, it could be splitting hairs here.
We don't want to get stuck on it either,
although I think it is key, this whole question. But I'll give a counterpoint because it's very current. So this morning, I woke up, as one does, and I really, really didn't want to get up. And I've had it throughout my life, but particularly in my adolescence, when I was going to school, it was really even. My mother even said that she couldn't believe I would get up every morning to go to school because I hated it so much. So it must have really been, you know, observable, my inertia around that. But anyway, so I still have it to this day sometimes, and I've had it recently and this morning. It was particularly strong, I'd say. And so, and what I do and what I did this morning, what happens is that I don't get up. I mean, I don't just say, well, I'm going to get up, even though I feel this way. Yeah. I say, I'm going to stay. I'm going to stay until as long as I want to stay.
Yes.
Essentially, as long as I need to stay. I didn't need to get up to pee, so that's it. That's the only kind of undeniable reason to get up, is if there's a biological urge that can't be denied. All the rest are just mental.
Yeah.
You know, ego.
Shoulds and things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but then, on the other hand, of course, as I'm sure you know from your own experience, there's also what you're talking about is that, well, this can also be, for lack of a better word, this is also ego that's keeping me in bed. This is all, there's a kind of will about not getting out of bed. Not that I was analysing it this much, but I was lying there thinking, well, if I'm going to stay in bed, and I just want it to be curled up and dark and very womb-like, what am I doing here? Besides avoiding, because avoiding is
hiding,
a negative thing.
Hiding,
it's not.
It's
not as though I have to punish myself, but still, it's not. There's nothing to be gained. There's nothing. Whatever, you know, that's not a good enough reason for me to be here. There must be a better reason. And so then my attention went on my body and the physical sensations in my body, and I remembered that the very same distress, let's say, or the very same emotional pattern that was keeping me, was preventing me from wanting to get out of bed, was what I was there to experience. And that was something carried over from the past, that this wasn't about my present situation and what was waiting for me when I got out of bed, or any of the mental reasons I would be giving myself to stay in bed or to not want to get out of bed. It was actually a somatic experience that I was having, and that was the reason to stay in bed, was to pay attention and be in that somatic experience and experience it. And actually, at a certain point, I started squeezing my arms and realizing that I really felt like I needed to be touched.
Mm.
And because I could feel a kind of toxins in my body, really, was what it felt like, just this build-up of poison and of angst and of distress in the body.
So that could have felt like what it was like in the womb.
So that may well have been what it was like in the womb.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Build-up of toxins in place of, you know, pure untoxic food, nourishment.
Yeah.
And love.
Yeah. So, and that's, I mean, that's our primal experience as consciousness in this life, is being a physical organism in an environment, interrelating, you know, interacting with the environment, connected to the environment, we're one with our environment in the womb. And the identity sprouts out of that over time. So I think we are sort of groping our way towards something, because if your environment, your womb, your original environment is polluted before you even have an identity, you just have a physical self, not even, you just have a physical presence, and that is in a polluted environment and being polluted by it, then the identity that forms is an identity that enables us to not experience that pollution and not experience the distress of that environment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've already, of course, written about this and analysed it a dozen different times, but just looking at it in a slightly different way. And but then there's something about how the very thing that we're trying to get away from, we end up creating, or we end up with a pattern of behaviour that constantly repeats the thing that we're trying to get away from. So then, if you're a polluted environment, you become a junkie to try and escape the distress, the psychic distress of that, but you're actually just recreating.
Mm.
You end up in a womb of your own making, you know, heroin addiction, to use the most obvious, but
yeah,
also apropos example. And movies being a lesser version of that, the Neptunian thing. And so then the whole world has been created collectively in that way, then we're all in this dissociated, trauma-based reenactment realm of fantasy delusion, fantasy pH, then it's not really any wonder that you have these vast and complex networks of abuse and control.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, it does make sense. When that's kind of what I was sort of creeping into my thinking or sort of growing awareness of my own experience of what you're, you know, working out yourself, what you're delivering, was that sense of it, that we're all humankind is, you know, suffering from, you know, some of us more than others, some of us growing into perpetrators and abusers, some of us not, but somehow there's this linked upness for all of us, which comes about, presumably, largely through this lack of, you know, truly loving parenting. And
mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's just Neptune. I think, well, I know, I'm sure that you agree with this, you know, it's there are emphases that vary, and there are overlaps, of course, but there's the Plutonic thing as well, which comes into the abusers, the sexual abusers,
yeah,
more than the escapists and the depressives, and that's more of the Neptunian thing.
Right, but you see how they work together. It's
yeah,
about the Pluto thing of violation and abuse,
yeah,
and abuse of power,
yeah,
and then you've got the dissociation of Neptune, which is a defence against that.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe someday, if you find them ghost-scattered castle of your mind, remember the times when we laughed, screaming together to the windy skies. And someday, my friend, if you find rabbit that runs as the day go by, fish that can swim as the turtle's eye, don't hesitate, don't pass me. And the young blossom maid that slurps tea will, can it be worth it for you and me? Flowers in garden of our youth can show you the way for the truth.
Well, I'm doing some work on that this morning, the sort of the power, the different kinds of abuse, and the sort of at the centre of this great web of pain.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of nucleus of it is the power complex.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you take on board what I think C.S. Lewis might have been the first one to say it, but Jung took it up anyway, that the opposite of power is not, the opposite of love is not hate, but power. You've heard this, haven't you?
Yeah.
He said, where love rules, there is no will to power, and where power predominates, there love is lacking. The one is the shadow of the other. But I think C.S. Lewis might have said it first, but anyway. So we grow up with a lack of love, which manifests in different forms of abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And we overcompensate for that. Or that part of that lack of love is constellates or is part of a power complex. And then you've got so the strands of abuse or the I've divided it between abuse and neglect. Obviously, they've got their abuse and neglect. They've got their roots in the same place, which is the lack of love, the power complex, the addictions, which comes really into power. You know, the ultimate opposite, one of the opposites of power is powerlessness, and the ultimate powerlessness is baby, infancy, childhood, and our own mortality. You know, so the power complex seeks out the abuse of the powerless, which is the children, and it also manifests in addiction, high levels of addiction, because we're powerless. The first step, I think, in the AA and the NA
mm-hmm.
steps are, you know, we admit that we're powerless over our addiction.
Yeah, so there's a sort of paradox in addiction in that you're reenacting powerlessness because you're using drugs to lose control, in a sense, to surrender to the drug. You're surrendering to the drug and giving it power over you, but you feel powerful because you can control your own moods.
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. And interesting, significantly, slight sort of tangent, but significantly, one of the things, I remember having this argument with Sebastian when he dipped his toe into the NA way, you know, went to countless meetings. He used to boast, you know, one of the things that he said was, hello, my name's Sebastian, I'm an addict, I've been coming to these rooms for 10 years and I'm 3 days clean, but everybody wants to know my secret, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So he went to countless meetings, but he never took up the path of the addict as offered by these, you know, this way. And I used to say to him, but he said, I have a problem accepting that, handing myself over to a higher power, accepting there's a higher power, which of course sounds exactly like him. And I'd say, but I don't understand, Sebastian, because it's just ordinary common sense. You hand yourself over to the power of crack and heroin
mm-hmm.
all the time. Your powerlessness, you're powerless over your relationship with. So you can hand over your power in this unbelievably, you know, self-destructive way, but you can't just make. He used to say about Kierkegaard, you know, I disagree with Kierkegaard. Right at the end, he's my man, he's my philosopher, he's my guru, though he wouldn't have used that word. Only at the end he turns left and I turn right, because he was a Christian and I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
See, so I'd say, well, why can't you do the same thing with the NA way? Why don't you go all the way, and instead of turning left and surrendering to the drug, turn right and surrender to God?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he wasn't able to do that because he wasn't strong enough.
Well, that last bit is kind of circular.
Yeah.
He wasn't strong enough because he wasn't able to do it. I mean, yeah, so it's unanswered.
Yeah, so you can scratch that from the record.
So there's another variable which, of course, you're aware of, but is that in the case of the neglecting father, as wounding as that can be in itself, simply having a father who's oblivious to one, doesn't validate one, there's the added factor of the father isn't there to provide a it's not a refuge, it's almost the opposite of a refuge, but a goad even, to help the child separate from the mother. Then the child remains vulnerable to the mother in ways that can become destructive, particularly if the mother is, and as would usually be the case if a father is absent or neglectful as a father, then he's probably that as a husband too. So then the wife mother reacts to that, and so that was our situation. So as harmful as our father's oblivion to us was, it was rendered much more so because it left me at least at the total mercy of the mother.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was more extreme for you. Though Sebastian, clearly, by the way he lived his life and died, did experience extreme levels of abuse and neglect.
And mother bondage.
Yeah, absolutely. And well, the fact that they died together. Mm-hmm. So they went down, as I said the other day, they went down together, didn't they? They couldn't...
I know we touched on this, but I haven't touched on it in public, really. A paper tiger, so I have. But, yeah, there was some sort of pact between them, which was semi-conscious, because they went out on dates together. I mean, that's how they saw it, them as dates, at least. Valerie did, anyway. I think Sebastian did too.
I know, she would dress up for him when he was coming round like a girlfriend. And there was that awful story towards the end. Do you remember this? Where she really couldn't eat anymore. She was throwing up every time she tried to eat anything. And he took her out for lunch on her birthday, maybe? But anyway, it was an occasion. And he took her to the Ivy. And she was incredibly anxious about it because... She was afraid of not being able to eat when he took her to the Ivy, but he was taking her out to lunch when she couldn't keep anything in her cancer-ridden stomach.
Mm-hmm. Is there an end to that story, or is it just...
Is there an end to it? I thought maybe that was
like
enough.
Unfinished story. Like,
no, there's no punchline. I mean, she... She couldn't eat. She had to go and throw up, and she was mortified, and he was deeply uncomfortable because she couldn't enjoy this thing that
she
was doing for it. No, it's horrific.
It's a microcosm of the whole thing.
And, you know, the sort of on the ordinary level, or not necessarily the ordinary level, but the sort of knee-jerk defended level, well, he's just trying to be nice. He just wanted to show her a lovely time and her birthday. She loves the Ivy. She loves dressing up, but it...
Because
it was torture.
Maintain the crucial friction to the end.
But maintaining the illusion that everything was not happening, yeah.
Yeah, by the specific elements of the illusion, right? The dressing up, the fancy restaurant, the food. Because the food goes back to what we're talking about, that we're first made to ingest poisons. Of course we can't absorb the nutrients of food. That's why I'm so thin. I think.
You think so? Mm. Well, certainly there's a legacy of anorexia. I don't know how far it goes back. I don't know what Ada was like. But, you know, Mum had a deeply ambivalent relationship with food and passed that on to me. I mean, I'm fine with food now, more or less, but it's taken me years to get here.
Yeah, I'm more or less okay with that, but I'm still skinny. So this began with the dichotomy of love and power.
Yeah.
And one of the things that it made me think of, which I think is part of what this whole tangle is relationship between love and power, and how if we don't receive love, which is the real nourishment, I mean you can say, like if Valerie had hadn't been damaged and had received love and been able to love, she wouldn't have been an alcoholic. So it's not just that we wouldn't have been polluted in the womb. I mean, it's not just that we would have got love from her in the womb, but also we wouldn't have got the poison. So, but if that is interfered with, if we don't receive love, then we're not able to love.
We seek power instead.
What I've begun to observe recently is that if I'm able to feel love for somebody, then there's less anxiety. The more I'm able to feel love for somebody that I'm interacting with, the less anxiety there is interacting with them, because where there's love, there's trust.
There's no agenda.
Yeah.
Is there?
There's just enjoyment, competition. Presence.
It's so then being with.
The reverse of that is if there's no love, then there's fear. And where there's fear, then we act to try and overcome the fear. And so we want to become powerful. We want to control the person.
Yeah, that's interesting, because that's another, somebody else, I can't remember who, said another opposite of power. Because obviously these things have different opposites, which I also find quite interesting. So it's not either or.
No, it's a whole cluster.
Yeah, it's a whole cluster, exactly, which is what the complex is. Mm-hmm. And another opposite of power is fear.
Well, opposite of love also.
Yeah, lack of trust. Fear, lack of trust. I've written some of these down. I was trying to find opposites for these, but again, they're not written in stone. But
yeah, it's in the deeper soul. Power and love are not opposites, but synonyms.
Oh, at the deep level?
Yeah. The only power there is.
This is sort of connecting to the source or something, isn't it? The life force, the source.
It's like that prayer, I am the love with which I love thee. So that's what Sebastian, what you're describing, Sebastian not being able to surrender to higher power, that was the power that he was not able to surrender to. And identifying it as God, i.e. the Father, as a way to maintain that oppositional stance.
Yeah.
Not that he would have suddenly surrendered if somebody had said, well, just call it love. But still, you can see how how the intellect participates in discerning and distorting and rationalisation.
Yeah, building the gates of defence. The cathedral of denial, he called it.
Right. And he also called the movies the forgetting chamber. So those two go hand in hand as well. So if the womb is unsafe or polluted or distressful, then we build a fortress. We start building a fortress even in the womb. We actually need to be protected from life itself. We feel we need to be.
Yeah. Yeah, or pretend to be dead, which is, again, depression.
Play dead, yeah.
Because if you're dead, you can't die. You can't be shot down. Nobody can take anything from you.
Mm. So that's that. The fog as well is enmeshed in the mother's psyche, the polluted womb, the psychic polluted womb, the polluted psychic womb of the mother, which is the world. I mean, that becomes the world, but it also is the world, because the world has been created by all of these, the same dissociated fragment people.
Yeah.
I forgot that was actually halfway to the thing that I got lost in the fog. Oh yeah, not being alive, we're never actually born. We're physically born, but we're never psychically born. We never begin individuation, never mind complete it. Most people. I mean,
big stuff, isn't it? We put it like that.
I mean, I would say I didn't begin individuating until my 40s and until Sebastian and Lowry were dying, you know, during the same period that they were, you know. Leading up to their deaths was also the period where I began individuating, because the period before, where I was all gung-ho about individuating in different terminology, was, as I've written about, I was embodying my brother, and I was become sort of an avatar, a receptacle for his poison, and all the sort of spiritualized fantasy of the mother. So, and it was, you know, it was all the constructed identity, the super ego doing its thing and trying to create, I suppose, you know, a fortress that looked like a palace or a cathedral, you know,
yeah,
as opposed to
gilding
the bars of the cage rather than just going through the open door.
Well, that's interesting because, I mean, we grew up in relative palaces, didn't we, really? All those houses that Mum bought, you were actually born
in the castle.
In a castle.
Yeah. Well, not literally born there, but...
Your first few days of your life were in a castle, fake castle.
It looks pretty real, actually. Looking at the picture, it's a pretty good job. But anyway, very medieval and very superfluous. I mean, what on earth that was about, all those houses, really. Well, the High Hall and Castle House, anyway, seemed.
Well, it's the inferiority, superiority swing, isn't it? So for Mum, because she chose all those houses, feeling so inferior, she had these completely grandiose notions and manifested them. And that had a huge impact on us because we all grew up thinking that we were better than other people.
Yeah, I wouldn't put that down to Mum, though. I mean, not only, of course, because that was how Alec was as well.
But Mum took the gauntlet and ran with it. None of the cousins had houses. Correct me if I'm wrong, you can all write in and say, my house is bigger than yours.
Yeah, well, I think there might be an interesting in Chinese sense, intersection between the Horsley line and Valerie's line.
Because
she did bring some weird sort of suppressed royal...
Yeah, I know. It's weird. Where did she get all those airs and graces from?
Yeah.
Because she... I mean, I don't suppose they were actually working class, her family. I think they were probably, like, lower middle class. Maybe some of them were working class, were they? I can't remember. Do you know? Do we know?
No.
The Morrises?
No.
But certainly they were poor.
Certainly... We were told they were anyway, because Alec talked about his parents as poor and they drove a Rolls Royce.
That's true.
But yeah, there's no particular reason besides doubting everything to doubt that part. And I mean, never really questioned it. It just seemed that something she'd picked up by. By her influences, through her influences, I suppose, now thinking about it for the first time, right? But that's a chicken or an egg thing too, because why was she so highbrow, really?
She was entitled. I mean, this is the thing that I discovered when I did my own work on my own, you know, kleptomania, you know, all those years and years and years of stealing that actually both you and I did.
Mm-hmm.
My epiphany was finding out that I was doing it. Well, you know this story through a dream I had, which showed me very, very clearly that I did not need to do what I was doing. And I was doing what I was doing because I felt entitled. And I felt entitled because I felt deprived.
Right. Which is paradoxical.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
I didn't get it. And I'm really entitled to it, therefore. It's a petulant, retaliatory, victimised, you know, response that manifests in grandiosity. And that would make sense with Mum, because she didn't get enough, and she wanted more, 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 more. And when she went to, before she met Nick, we only found this out recently, didn't we, that she didn't happen to be in New Orleans on a whim, floated there, you know, like a, whatever she called herself, a will-o'-the-wisp. But she was actually on the run because she owed thousands of dollars to Saks Fifth Avenue for all those frocks that she had to have that she couldn't pay for.
And then somehow the story that she won her fare to New Orleans by catching a winning balloon in some raffle, which Sebastian reproduced in his memoir, almost certainly untrue based on this new information, therefore as a kind of microcosmic example of how they colluded to maintain the fiction.
Yeah. Yeah.
In this case, the fiction being that Vary was kind of a criminal, or actually a criminal, not a neo-hippie floating around, you know, following her bliss. But also a victim, because he reproduces the failed rape account without the detail about her dissociating.
Yeah.
He just makes a joke of it, of course.
He makes it, yeah.
Even puts a joke in her mouth, I think, that she would never have made.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that annoyed me about his book. Amongst the few things that did annoy me, one of them was, I told you this at the time, was that he made Mum witty.
Yeah.
And she never was. She was many things, but not witty. But it was just basically because every single character,
Well, it wasn't just getting jokes in, it was getting his opinions in, because he also made Mum hate jazz, when Mum didn't hate jazz. Yeah, in New Orleans.
Yeah, that's right.
But anyway, that's a side beef. There ends this week's podcast, first of 2016. This conversation with Ashley Horsley will continue the following Wednesday, which will be the 13th of January. I'd like to give thanks to Aileen and to Sivasoslav. I hope I pronounced that at least somewhat correct. As of this week, I'll be serializing Prisoner of Infinity, part one, for a recap, and as preparation for part two, which I will then be serializing for the first time online. And I hope to be accompanying that with conversations on this podcast about the subject matter contained therein. So here we are.